Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, after several months of hand-wringing and political posturing, the efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act came up short in Congress. The Republican American Healthcare Act never made it to the House floor. Some analysts are calling this a stunning defeat for the GOP and the president, all of whom promised to repeal and replace Obamacare with something better.
Well, there was a groundswell of opposition to the replacement legislation, particularly when the Congressional Budget Office predicted the GOP law would not only cost many consumers more money, but would lead to 24 million Americans losing their health coverage. The bill's author, House Speaker Paul Ryan, admitted defeat, saying apparently Obamacare would be the law of the land for the foreseeable future.
There will still be health care legislation requiring budgetary approval, and that's an area where a simple majority is needed in the Senate. So I think this isn't the last we've heard on health reform.
But, you know, there are areas of healthcare that are transforming outside the scope of policymakers and legislation, areas that we think are poised to improve access to care and outcomes of care across many sectors of healthcare. And one of those very promising areas is certainly telehealth or telemedicine.
Our guest today, Peter Yellow-Lees, president-elect of the American Telemedicine Association. Really looking forward to that conversation, Margaret.
And Lori Robertson will be checking in, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She is always on the lookout for misstatements made about health policy in the public domain. And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Peter Yellow-Lees in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The swift death of the American Healthcare Act still leaves many questions in its wake, chief among them, what comes next? House Speaker Paul Ryan said it is the law of the land for the foreseeable future, but some calls for bipartisanship are starting to rise to the surface. Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine says the collapse of the GOP health bill actually paves the way now for some true bipartisan solution making. She was among a vocal minority of Senate Republicans who were opposed to the intent of the American Health Care Act, which would have removed many consumer protections and would have led to the loss of insurance coverage for an estimated 24 million Americans. She said more Democrats may feel free to come to the table. The human papillomavirus is responsible for 6 known cancers in adults, and the HPV vaccine is the only known hedge against catching the virus. But still, a relatively low percent of teenage girls and boys are getting the recommended dose of 3 vaccinations spread out from age 9 to age 14. Now, a study shows the most current form of the vaccine, Gardasil 9, only requires 2 doses in the same age group. The vaccine protects against 9 types of HPV, ones that are responsible for over 90% of cervical cancers or a variety of cancers in other parts of the body connected to sexual contact. In 2015, only about 30% of teen girls have been properly vaccinated and 25% of the boys. There are almost 40,000 HPV-related cancers diagnosed per year, and that number would be significantly reduced with proper vaccination. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Peter Yellow-Lees, professor of clinical psychiatry at the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health Sciences and vice chair of faculty development at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Yellow-Lees serves on the National Academy of Sciences Review Committee evaluating mental health services at the Veterans Administration. He is president-elect of the American Telemedicine Association, the leading international organization promoting the use of remote medicine technologies in healthcare. He's written over 200 peer-reviewed articles. He earned his medical degree in behavioral science at the Royal Free Hospital School of Medicine. Dr. Yellow-Lees, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
You know, over the past few years, there's been a significant growth in the interest and uptake of telehealth and telemedicine in the United States. And before coming to the United States, you spent your earlier career practicing psychiatric medicine in Australia. I wonder if you could tell our listeners about your early experience utilizing telemedicine and help us understand the scope and potential of telehealth in the United States.
Sure. I was living in Australia for a number of years and at one stage lived in the outback. I'm a psychiatrist by training, and the area that I was responsible for was actually the same landmass as California. So imagine that there's one psychiatrist for the whole of California.
Wow.
That meant that I spent a lot of time on airplanes to do clinics. I got very used to using the telephone to speak to sort of suicidal people. And so I got interested in telemedicine and remote technologies. Really, from a clinical point of view, I just had a problem. I couldn't manage the whole area all by myself. You might be interested to know how much I actually had to pay for the first video conferencing machines that I bought back in about 1990.
Right.
You know, they were actually $170,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. We remember those $300 calls.
Right, exactly. It was just incredible. So it was never going to be economically viable in those days, but it was very interesting from a research point of view, and I guess that's what's driven me over the years to try and demonstrate how effectively you can use these technologies. I mean, the differences now are just, you know, dramatic. And really, technology is no longer a problem. You know, you can do more on your phone now than you could on those early systems that I spent an enormous amount of money on. There's been also a huge change in attitudes, particularly with the younger generation. People under 30, you know, we typically think of as being digital natives who've never lived without the internet and who have different expectations of being able to get information immediately, whereas you know, people in my generation in reality are what we call digital immigrants, and that just leaves us with a different set of attitudes, unfortunately. And then people always used to think of telemedicine or using these technologies as being an either-or choice situation, and the reality of life is that increasing numbers of patients are being seen in a hybrid manner. You know, they sometimes see their doctor in person, they sometimes see them online. And essentially, the doctor-patient relationship nowadays, you know, with the help of technology, has become a much more fluid and, quite honestly, better relationship.
Well, Dr. Yellowlees, UC Davis has been a leader in the use of telemedicine, I think having utilized some form of telehealth since 1992. And your department at UC Davis has just released a longitudinal analysis of outcome data that's culled from almost 20 years and looks at everything from improved patient access to care. What did the study reveal in terms of improved access and also cost savings?
The two biggest disciplines that we have using it are actually psychiatry and dermatology. We also do quite a lot of emergency medicine, particularly in the child area, pediatrics, and actually it's Professor Jim Marson who's the lead author on this study, and he's a pediatrician. So what essentially Dr. Marson did was to just review 20 years' worth of consultations, and he looked at the disciplines involved. And, you know, what we found is that clearly access is improved. The clinical outcomes for the individual patients that we've seen generally are at least as good as if they were seen in person, but they tend to have less hospitalizations. And that's actually where the savings are in telemedicine. Mm-hmm. And if you look at our results and also the results from a number of studies from the VA, what you find is that because you can access patients often earlier in their illness, but you get savings through less emergency visits and less hospitalizations. And then obviously the final thing that Dr. Marson did was to look at carbon emission that has been reduced through the use of telemedicine. And this is a very important issue, and it's something that at the national level, the American Telemedicine Association is going to be taking up. Because clearly if we can in fact have less travel in medicine by using more telemedicine, more remote monitoring, then we will absolutely reduce the amount of carbon that goes into the environment and thereby slow climate change.
So your experience is a little different. Maybe you can tell us, are there other randomized clinical trials going on to sort of look at the cost-benefit analysis that clearly everybody would want to see in what looks like a better way to deliver, redesign part of the delivery system?
Yes, I think, you know, if in fact you look more broadly at savings and you look at the savings made by both patients and providers, then in fact you find telemedicine incredibly efficient because, I mean, you know yourself that it's common to have to take a half day off work to go and see your doctor. Mm-hmm. If you could in fact just log in from your work and see your doctor in a sort of half hour slot, you'd save an enormous amount of time and potential money and time at work. So I think we have to look broadly at the savings that you make through these technologies, and if you include patients in the actual equation, then the savings become really, really impressive.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Yellowlees, you've also spent some considerable time, I think, focusing on the efficacy of asynchronous telepsychiatry, utilizing, I understand, taped interviews with patients and then sharing them with a psychiatrist. And I understand that's a tool that you've used for some time in your own practice. What's different about this approach from other approaches in telemedicine?
For many years in psychiatry, we've done what we call curbside consultations, mm-hmm. so that a primary care doc will ring a psychiatrist, will have maybe a 2 to 4 minute conversation with that person. The psychiatrist will give them an opinion. All we're doing with the asynchronous telepsychiatry is saying that's a great model to use, but why don't we actually record the patient? And instead of me just ringing you about the patient, I can actually send you a recording of the patient. Mm-hmm. You can get to see what they look like. You can get to see how they answer questions, and then you can give me an opinion. It's really very simple. We've seen many hundreds of patients like this now. We've done a number of studies showing that you can be just as accurate diagnostically. We're not obviously providing therapy like this. We are able, however, to monitor people, and we've been doing a study recently looking at several hundred patients who have chronic medical and psychiatric illnesses, and we're doing these asynchronous consultations every 6 months to basically help the primary care doc with their overall management of their patient.
We're speaking today with Dr. Peter Yellowlees, President-elect of the American Telemedicine Association, Professor of Clinical Psychiatry at the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health Sciences at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Yellowlees serves on the National Academy of Science Review Committee evaluating mental health services at the Veterans Administration. I'd really like to talk a little bit about the VA. Obviously, it's been struggling to improve timely access and health outcome for American vets. And given that you're serving in an advisory capacity, what are you sharing from your own personal and clinical experience that you believe will help improve access as well as outcomes?
Sure. The VA is actually the world leader in telemedicine as an organization. They have been amazing. They've done a lot of work in this area in multiple different specialties. Now, in my own discipline, for instance, of mental health, they did something like 500,000 consultations in the last year. And they've done some very nice research showing that these consultations are highly cost-effective, as I mentioned earlier on, mainly because patients tend to get admitted to hospital less frequently. What I think the VA needs to do, in reality, is to expand their use of telemedicine even more. If you look at post-traumatic stress disorder, for instance, as an illness, the nature of the illness is that people tend to be avoidant. They tend to prefer not to have to go out and deal with perhaps the local hospital or the local bureaucracy. And there's a lot of evidence, in fact, that if you can video conference or connect with veterans in their homes, that you can actually provide better care using technologies than you can in person, and you get better results. There's been several very good studies of PTSD showing actually more engagement of veterans in treatment, and particularly in psychotherapy. So there's been some really interesting studies that the VA has done that really, I guess, paved the way for what I hope will be a substantial increase in their use of these types of treatment modalities.
Well, Dr. Yellowlees, I understand you have a very keen interest in online learning and its game-changing potential in medical training. How do you see it potentially shifting the paradigm of health profession training in the coming years?
Sure. I think one of the things that we've really learned is that in particular the younger generations really do see the world and interact with the world very differently from people of my generation, who are typically the teachers. And so, we need to connect with them. We need to work in the way that they prefer to work and they're used to working. We need to, essentially move away from the tradition of sort of hour-long lectures and, the sort of non-interactive approach, sort of almost a passive-dependent approach of traditional education, and become much more experiential, much more interactive, and provide information in shorter amounts, but in a very concentrated and focused way. So we're developing all sorts of, literally bytes of information. For instance, I've been working with Medscape for the last 8 years now to produce the Medscape Psychiatry Minute, which is, available free for anyone.
Yeah.
There are something like 160 of those Medscape Psychiatry Minutes available on the web now, none of which are more than 2 minutes long. But all of which focus on a very specific paper and then some comments and editorial thoughts that I have about that particular paper. And they're clearly able to reach an enormous audience, very much more than you can possibly reach in the traditional approach to teaching, you know, in a lecture theatre. So I think we've got to really think very carefully about essentially our consumers of information in healthcare. And the consumers basically want online information. They want it just in time when they need it now. And they want it, you know, in a visual way.
Dr. Yelalees, obviously there are lots of changes going on in the American healthcare system. The American Telemedicine Association probably found some wind in its sails under the Affordable Care Act in terms of advancing your cause. I'm wondering what your agenda is for your organization as it seeks to advance in this new political environment, more access and better reimbursement for telemedicine. What's the agenda look like?
Sure, I think this is a really important issue. And telemedicine, I think in reality, is actually supported by both sides of the political spectrum. The beauty of it, quite honestly, is that it increases the efficiency of the healthcare system. And it is particularly likely to be successful in an environment where there are sort of capitated payments or where you pay for services over time. And that's very much the direction that the Centers for Medicare have been going in. You know, we don't know if that's going to change, but, you know, the general approach from certainly both federal and state regulators is to start trying to pay for care over periods of time. And it's in that environment that telemedicine is really valuable. And so the ATA is very positive about the political climate overall and are keen to progress these discussions.
Well, Dr. Yelalees, you've said that things like Google Glass and mobile health are potentially poised to really transform the patient-provider experience by adding real-time data and health monitoring to a patient's profile. And then maybe just talk with us a minute about some of the more promising technological advances that are supporting the growth of telehealth. And are there any clear technological hurdles that you think we have yet to overcome?
Well, I think the best way of answering this is to think about two examples of slightly more futuristic projects I've been involved in the last few years. And the first is one that has been run out of my own lab, and that's where we're looking at automating the process of translation, language translation. And I think that's really important. We know that people who don't have English as a natural first language do worse in the healthcare system, despite, you know, all of the attempts of the many interpreters that we use. They spend longer in hospital, they get less good care. And so we're working on essentially developing automated translation systems that will allow you to interview and record patients and then have that immediately spun back, you know, in real time, essentially in any other language you choose, so that you can, you know, take a patient who speaks Hmong, have that that interview immediately reviewed by maybe an English-speaking physician. So I think that's one area that is potentially enormous, and that can be done both in person with patients, perhaps via you know, iPads or phones or, you know, Google Glass type devices, or it can be done you know, on video at a distance. So, and I think you'll find that within a few years we'll be using those sorts of systems pretty routinely. The second one is, you know, is more way out than that, and that's the potential to use, say, virtual reality. There's been a lot of studies looking at that in medicine generally, and essentially creating avatars for both patients and providers and then getting them to meet in the cloud. But there's some fascinating studies that are being done at USC at the moment in Los Angeles, where they've actually developed a whole series of avatar providers. So that if, for instance, you know, you have depression or PTSD, you can literally log on and you can speak to a, you know, a therapist who is, and the therapist is an avatar that is basically trained to respond to your questions and your movements in certain ways that are hopefully helpful. Now, we're certainly not there yet with automated providers, but I think that's down the track.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Peter Yelalees, President-elect of the American Telemedicine Association, Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Vice Chair of Faculty Development at the University of California, Davis. You can learn more about his work by going to ucdavis.edu/medicalcenter/PeterYelalees-psychiatry, or you can follow him on Twitter at Peter Yelalees. And you can also follow the American Telemedicine Association at American Telemed. Dr. Yelalees, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations in Healthcare today.
Thank you very much indeed, both Mark and Margaret. This has been most interesting, and I appreciate your time.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Both Democrats and Republicans have been spinning the Congressional Budget Office's analysis of the Republican healthcare bill. The White House budget director oversold what the CBO said about the bill's impact on premiums. Mick Mulvaney, the director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, said the CBO report confirmed the GOP philosophy that a free market would reduce premiums. Mulvaney said, quote, CBO says that premiums will go down by at least 10% with this plan. Premiums on the non-group market, where individuals buy their own insurance, will not go down from what they are right now. They will just be lower than what they would be under the Affordable Care Act on average by 2026. Also, Mulvaney ignores two important points. Average premiums would increase in the first 2 years, and older Americans would see substantial increases in the short and long run. The CBO report says that in 2018 and 2019, average premiums on the non-group market would be 15% to 20% higher than under current law for a single person's policy. For older Americans, the GOP plan would allow insurers to charge them up to 5 times as much as younger people. Under the ACA, the ratio was 3-to-1. CBO said that would lead to premiums for a 64-year-old that would be 20% to 25% higher by 2026. The GOP plan changes the current income-based tax credits for those buying their own insurance to age-based tax credits. But CBO said those wouldn't be large enough to offset the premium increases for older Americans. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Pregnancy is normally an exciting time for most women, but according to the research, an estimated 10% of prenatal women experience some kind of depression during their pregnancy, and many are reluctant to treat their depression with medication for fear of harming the fetus.
In fact, a higher percentage are experiencing lower grade depressive symptoms, so they might not meet full criteria for a major depressive episode, and left untreated, those mild to moderate symptoms can progress, in some cases lead to a more serious postpartum depression.
Dr. Cynthia Battle is a psychologist at Brown University with a practice at Women's and Infants Hospital in Providence. She and her colleagues decided to test a cohort of pregnant women to see if a targeted prenatal yoga class, which combines exercise with mindfulness techniques, might have a positive impact on women dealing with prenatal depression.
And it was a typical kind of hatha yoga that would include physical postures, meditation exercises. And we enrolled 34 women who were pregnant who had clinical levels of depression, and we measured their change in depressive symptoms over that period of time.
Not only were women able to manage their depressive incidents, they also bonded with other pregnant women during the program and found additional support from their group.
Women who are depressed during pregnancy, unfortunately, do often have less ideal birth outcomes. So one thing we're interested in seeing if when we provide prenatal yoga program, can it improve mood? And then can we even see some positive effects in terms of the birth outcomes?
A guided non-medical yoga exercise program designed to assist pregnant women through depression symptoms without medication, ensuring a safer pregnancy and a healthier outcome for mother and baby. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.